Welcome, everybody, to Apropos of Something. This is 94.7 WPVC Resistance Radio, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Again, welcome to Apropos of Something, airing every Saturday morning from 10 to 11, co-hosted by me, Ellen Daniels, in our Charlottesville studio, and Nancy Lawrence from our studio in New York City. We seek out the most interesting people we can find with a passion for social justice, political activism, and the arts, and we guarantee every show will be apropos of something. We are very grateful for the sponsorship of the Beckham team at Keller Williams Realty. Today, we're talking about the opioid epidemic in this country with the distinguished professor of law, Richard Bonney, director of the Institute of Law, Psychiatry, and Public Policy at the University of Virginia. Bonney is a towering figure in the fields of mental health and substance abuse public policy, criminal law, juvenile justice, and bioethics. He has literally written the textbooks on criminal law and public health law. His first book, The Marijuana Conviction, A History of Marijuana Prohibition in the United States, was republished as a drug policy classic. Bonney was elected to the National Academy of Medicine in 91. He's chaired numerous studies on subjects ranging from elder mistreatment to underage drinking, and a landmark report ending the tobacco problem, and most recently, a study released this year on ending the opioid problem, and we will discuss how we got here and what needs to be done. Also on the program, Ryan Wright. Wright is an associate professor in the McIntyre School of Commerce at the University of Virginia. We'll discuss cybersecurity and privacy, the dark web, spies, spying on spies in the Kaspersky scandal, protecting ourselves when we travel, and much more. You can check out all our past shows on the station website, 947wpvc.org. Nancy Lawrence, I must ask, are you there?
Ooh, I am there. Ellen, I have to say it again. Your intros are absolutely stellar.
Well,
they are.
What are the intros?
I just want to take a seat and let you continue. Maybe I will. I have nothing. Go ahead.
It's really because of the amazing people that have done the work that provide those.
I realize.
Okay.
I know.
Just saying.
I mean, it is more about them than you. I do realize that.
Yes. But,
anyway.
I'm never one to turn down a compliment, so I do appreciate it.
Okay. There you go.
You know. So,
considering that the week, you know, every week that we wind up on a Saturday seems worse than the week before, it's just a very nice open to the show.
It is mind-numbing the headlines I was scanning this morning. The word mindless cruelty has probably come up many more times than other administrations. But mindless cruelty to a soldier widow speaks to the core of his character by the Washington Post. Jeff Flake's op-ed, enough, it's time to stand up to Trump. And then New York Times op-ed by a Democratic senator saying why Jeff Flake's exit should scare Democrats.
I'm sorry, you were saying.
No, I mean, I don't know if that's obvious, but just, you know, it's just a signal that even just conservative Republicans can see an autocrat, you know, they know one when they see one.
Yeah, they say stuff, but they don't do anything. I mean, I love that he stood in front of the Senate and said what he said, but then they went and voted. What'd they do? They went and voted.
Oh, sorry. That was me.
Oh, excuse me.
Did you hear something?
I take it all back what I said about you.
What was it? I don't even know how that happened.
I can use the audio assist.
It was my fault. But
anyway,
I don't know.
They went and voted 51 to 50 to do something horrible once again to America. They slashed funding for something. They did something horrible. They agreed with him on something once again. You know what I mean? So until they do stuff, I'm so skeptical that they will. In fact, I'm holding my breath. It's like constitutional crisis countdown now that Mueller may. It sounds like he definitely has won, at least, indictment, and there may be more, whatever. You know, now that whenever it is that Mueller hands out these things and people get names come out, I'm holding my breath if we keep it together or if we literally come apart the country, you know. What are they going to do to this guy, meaning Mueller, actually? You know, is he going to fire him? All that stuff that everyone talks about, you know, I put nothing past Trump, obviously.
Right.
And hey, what if I told you this, though? Speaking of
Go ahead.
Insulting, grieving Gold Star families and calling a congresswoman an empty barrel, so what if I told you that this month, although it's ending shortly, is actually, or maybe you know this, National Bullying Prevention Month? What do you think of that?
That's amazing.
We did so horribly. But it That's actually amazing. Is. Yeah. And the same month that he did all that and attacked the mayor of Puerto Rico and the media's.
Wasn't Melania going to take up anti-bullying?
She did.
For a minute.
She went to Michigan with her good friend, Miss DeVos.
And again, the election is just 2 weeks away here in Virginia. So it's the biggest election since Trump took office. So I would advise people to. It's too late to make sure if you're registered, but definitely vote and help out. Today at 3, in fact, people are meeting at the Democratic Combined Campaign to door knock. And someone really famous, I'm not going to mention her name, but someone actually really famous knocked on my door, and it wasn't a political candidate. So everyone is out there doing their best, and I would encourage everyone to do the same. They knocked on my door to campaign. I don't know if I made that clear, but it was really cool.
That sounds very cool. I heard that Northam,
mm-hmm. Northam.
Yes, not who's Gillespie. Excuse me. I heard Gillespie is like doing completely different ads all around your state, depending on who's the voting public he's going after. I was just wondering what kind are you seeing on your on your
how he's involved with gangs and many.
Oh,
other
you're people. Getting that one.
It's horrible. Yeah. It's horrible. Yeah. And children, how he doesn't want to protect children. It's just horrible. So I just want to go. You had an event. I want to get going with our show since it's so amazing this week.
Yes, I just wanted to remind everyone, speaking of getting out of October, that November 1st starts open enrollment for the ACA coverage. You know, even though Trump is doing everything he can to make you forget that insurance is available still, it's from November 1st through only December 15th because they cut that in half, as well as hours that you can register online in half. Everything's cut in half with this guy, except his
including our patients.
Cuts.
Our patients, including our patients, is cutting.
Anyway, that was the one. The ACA starts on November 1st.
Okay. Well, I want to get right to our first guest, Richard Bonney. Richard J. Bonney is the Harrison Foundation Professor of Law and Medicine, Professor of Public Policy, Professor of Psychiatry and Neurobehavioral Sciences, and the Director of the Institute of Law, Psychiatry, and Public Policy at the University of Virginia. He's done such important work affecting public policies relating to mental health, substance abuse, and juvenile justice reform. His accomplishments are too numerous to do them justice, but just a few more. He was secretary of the First National Advisory Council on Drug Abuse, chair of Virginia State Human Rights Committee, responsible for protecting rights of people with mental disabilities, and he chaired a commission on mental health law reform at the request of the Chief Justice of Virginia from 2006 to 2011. He received UVA's highest honor, the Thomas Jefferson Award, and in 2003 and 2016, he was awarded the American Psychiatric Association's Special Presidential Commendation for his contributions to the field of law and psychiatry. And his most recent work, or the most recent work I know about, is that he chaired a National Academy's report on which gave extensive recommendations on the opioid problem and how to curb the problem. And we are going to focus on that today. So I wanted to welcome Richard Bonney to the program. Welcome.
Well, thank you. Glad to be here.
So first, I've just been hearing so much lately, and I'm wondering why I'm hearing so much lately in the last couple of weeks on this problem.
Well, I think there's been increasing awareness about the seriousness of the opioid problem, I think, for some time. And I think it's recently been getting a great deal of attention because of the president. The president did appoint a commission to advise him about the opioid problem pretty soon after he took office, and Chris Christie has been chairing it. They issued a preliminary report in July, which was a couple of weeks after our report came out for the National Academy of Sciences. And I have to say, many of the preliminary recommendations in that report were really congruent with many of the recommendations that we had made as well. I think they had paid attention to our report. And one of the president was urged to declare a national public health emergency on the opioid problem, and he did give a statement which did so this week. So I think this is all actually very positive because it is an urgent problem and needs presidential leadership.
And what's the urgency? Can you describe what's going on?
Well, I think this is clearly a serious problem of great magnitude. Just to give a couple of figures, there are probably over now 2 million people who are addicted to opioids and became addicted to opioids. They may be using both the prescription and the non-prescription opioids now, but became addicted by beginning with medically prescribed opioids. And then there are another 600,000 or so people who are addicted to heroin. And those two things are related. And that is a huge number, and it's only going to get worse. In addition, the number of overdose deaths, I think people have been focusing on that, and the number of deaths due to opioid overdose have quadrupled over the last 15 years. The numbers that have been attributed to opioid use, medically prescribed, are somewhere in the neighborhood of 100 a day. And so we're talking about really huge numbers of deaths, and the number that is attributable basically to heroin overdose or overdose with illicit drugs in the marketplace, such as fentanyl, has tripled over the last 5 years. So this is a huge, huge problem, and I think people are increasingly aware of how serious it is. But part of our message in our report is that it's going to get worse before it gets better. There's no indication that this is leveling off, this is why it's so urgent to kind of get a hold of this. And another thing we said too is that this is not something you're going to fix overnight. It took, let's say, 15 years for this epidemic to develop to the point that it has, and with all those people who are addicted, you know, to these drugs, it's going to take a very long time of sustained and coordinated effort to really get this under control. So it's urgent, and it needs a sustained response.
How did it get so bad for so long? Why did it take this long to come out into the light?
Well, so that's a complicated question. I think that for a while, I would say this was a bit of a hidden, you know, epidemic, because we've had an endemic heroin problem in this country for many years. I mean, ebb and flow really since the beginning of the 20th century. And so I think we are used to that and think of that as an ongoing challenge for public policy. I think we take our eye off the ball too often, and we use the wrong response too often. And that is what happened with regard to the last war on drugs. That one was particularly focused on cocaine. But we have had an endemic heroin problem, and one way that I think about that is, you know, maybe it sort of varied over the years between, let's just say, 250,000 and maybe 700,000, you know, people who were addicted. And now, when you think about the numbers that we're dealing with now, it is just an order of magnitude worse than any such epidemic that we have ever had. And I think in the initial phases of this, when this was, you know, arising out essentially of an overprescribing of opioids for chronic pain, that there were a number of contributors to that in terms of how prescribing practices changed, and people then became, you know, addicted to the drugs, and a lot of serious consequences that then flowed from that. I think when it began to be publicly understood, you know, there was at that point the beginning of a concentrated response to it, but it still hadn't reached the kind of the level of national visibility that we are seeing now. And one of the encouraging things, frankly, I do want to emphasize, one of the encouraging things about this now is that this is not a partisan issue. I mean, there's clearly bipartisan support. This is not one of those many, many, many things that are so polarized and divisive, you know, in our country. And so that's, I think, a very hopeful sign. And I do think the raising level of awareness, also another thing about the changing nature of the opioid problem is, you know, the demographic changes in the range of people in the society, really, of all income levels and all racial and ethnic ethnic groups that are being affected by this. And it also ties up, of course, with you know, the problems in our economy of demoralization of various parts of the country. It's also, you know, related to that. And I think for all of those reasons, people are aware of this. And partly what I want to say is it's critical that people sustain their attention to this, and that we maintain and sustain a response to it. This is not, we have a tendency in our country to you know, our attention is directed to a problem, and we say we have to do something about this problem, and then we lose attention because something else has gotten our attention. This, we can't do that. We have to put a sustained response in play.
Yeah, there's a lot of distractions. I can't imagine what those might be. But I'm glad it's not, it's a nonpartisan. I was going to ask you why the administration, or the regime, as I like to call them, is behind this. So that is really, really hopeful.
Well, it's part of their constituency that's really affected by this. And, you know, again, this is, you know, it shouldn't be understood to be a partisan problem. You know, it affects everybody. It's touched every family in some way. The president is right about that. So, again, I think it's important, you know, that there's direct presidential attention, you know, to this problem. I think what he did the other day is a first step. But this, many of the actors, and this is Chris Christie reflects this, many of the politicians that have been, you know, really focusing on this problem, again, all parties, have been at the state and local level, because that's where the attend, you know, the initiatives, many of them have been undertaken. Mm-hmm. But it can't be done only at the state and local level. It needs national attention, it needs national leadership, and it needs huge increases in funding for substance abuse treatment, and particularly opioid treatment. We can talk about that later. Mm-hmm. But that's one of the criticisms, I think, that we're hearing about what the president did so far, is that this is a good step, first step. But there was no money attached to what the president actually did this week, and we have got to increase available funding for providing substance abuse treatment to people with opioid use disorders.
Were you disappointed that he called it a public health emergency rather than a national emergency?
Well, you know, I think, you know, this is, I think the tendency that we have, you know, to say there are good things that are happening, you know, but it really should have been this, or what it really should have been that. I think the fact that it's gotten presidential attention is the most important thing. And, you know, we've been characterizing it as an urgent, you know, problem. One of the reasons that we didn't want to actually emphasize the emergency part of that is that that's a legal declaration, and what the powers are that are then galvanized and mobilized to deal with the problem depends upon state law and federal law. And so now the argument is, well, you know, the public health emergency only triggered these powers. If he had called it a national emergency, it would trigger other powers. I think that's a distraction, you know, to some extent. The key issue is, no matter what we do, we have got to invest in the interventions that are going to be necessary to bring this under control. And we have to take aggressive regulatory action at the state and the national level. Our report was done for the Food and Drug Administration. They asked for it because they needed to have a model of regulation so that they could regulate these drugs, you know, better and in a more aggressive way. And one of the positive signs right now is both the previous commissioner of the Food and Drug Administration, as well as the one, Scott Gottlieb, that was appointed by this administration, are strongly supportive of taking aggressive regulatory action. So there are a lot of reasons to be hopeful about what's going to happen, but we have got to have resources to provide, you know, some of these interventions that are necessary, and particularly those that are treatment.
You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. This is Apropos of Something, airing every Saturday morning from 10 to 11. We're talking with Richard J. Bonney. He is the Director of Institute of Law and Psychiatry and Public Policy at the University of Virginia, and we are discussing the opioid epidemic in this country. We'll be right back with more from Richard Bonney and also Ryan Wright. We're going to talk about the dark web and spies, spying on spies in the Kaspersky scandal in just a bit. Welcome back, everyone. This is Apropos of Something on 94.7 WPVC. We're speaking with Richard Bonney, the Harrison Foundation Professor of Law and Medicine. We're talking about the opioid epidemic, and he was chair of a really big report released just this year. I wanted to ask you, Richard, can you tell us, what did you recommend in that report? What did your team uncover, and what do you recommend be done?
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to tell you that. The the report was a long report. It was about 500 pages long, and there are many recommendations in. I will just highlight, you know, six key areas that are important here. First of all, we need a culture change in the prescribing of opioids. There's no doubt that even though it's not the only factor, that one of the key factors underlying this epidemic was the increased prescribing of opioids for chronic pain. There's no doubt that opioids are effective, and there have been preparations of opioids that have been, you know, available since the Civil War, really, you know, such as morphine, for example, that are helpful for acute pain, you know, so we have post-surgical pain in that context. So there's no doubt about that, and the prescribing of that has not, you know, been an issue, although some people are often given huge numbers of opioid drugs to take home with them when they leave the hospital that are much more than they ever need. And then they can find their way into the illegal market, and that needs to stop, and is probably already stopping. Also, with regard to people who have cancer-related pain or pain at the end of life, again, there's no doubt that the opioid drugs are extremely helpful in alleviating suffering, you know, at the end of life, sometimes not, you know, fully, and people do continue to suffer. But there's no doubt that that's an appropriate indication. Again, you have an issue there of prescribing and then giving people much, much more of a supply that they need that then can find their way into the hands of family members or others. So that's a huge issue, because there are so many hundreds of millions of these pills that are out there in the world, and that's part of the problem. But the real vector for this epidemic from a prescribing standpoint was the lowering of what had been traditional barriers, educationally speaking, to prescribing of opioids for people who have chronic back pain, chronic pain related to arthritis, or whatever, because for generations, physicians had been warned against prescribing these drugs because of the risk of addiction for people that take them, you know, on a continuing basis. What happened in the 1990s, for a variety of reasons, including preparation of new formulations that were said not to be addictive, that there was a lot of promotion of the use of the drugs, particularly, you know, among physicians. There was a reduced attention to pain management in physician education. There's so many things that physicians need to learn about in undergraduate medical education, gradually reduced the amount of time that was spent on pain management. So over time, I think we had a certain vulnerability in terms of physician education that then led to this significant overprescribing of these drugs. We prescribe hugely more of these drugs in this country than anywhere else in the world. And so there's an issue there. And so what we've said is you've got to change the culture of prescribing. And that's already begun because of the intention that's being given to this, but also more pain education, more education about substance abuse disorders and opioid use disorders among physicians. So that's a hugely important issue. The medical profession and public health leadership has to really get a hold of this. And the FDA, I think, will try to help push that along. The state medical societies, all those, players need to play a role in this. So that's the first thing. Second thing, as I've already said, we have to increase our investment in substance abuse treatment, and particularly for opioid use disorders, and particularly for using medically prescribed drugs that are available to help people with opioid use disorder. There are effective drugs. They are, unfortunately, not widely available. They're because of cost and other impediments, and the fact that we don't have enough providers, actually, to do it. So we need to increase the number of providers that are available to provide these drugs, and we have to make the drugs and other associated treatment. It's not only the drugs. It's other counseling and other assistance that people need. We need to increase access. We're doing this well now to medications that can reverse the effects of overdose. Naloxone is the name of the drug, and I think people maybe are becoming aware of the possibility that if that drug is available when people have an overdose, it's an antidote and it can rest, it can save people's lives. And so that's critically important, removing a lot of the barriers that exist, again, financial as well as legal barriers. State and local governments are moving in that direction. The federal government can help. We need to stay on that one, too. I mentioned the fourth thing is increasing FDA regulatory authority here and taking a more aggressive approach approach, and we've given the FDA a kind of a framework within which they could do that. We need to strengthen the data and surveillance about the problem of the treatment of pain and opioids at every level. One of the reasons that this epidemic was under the radar for so long is we didn't have the data systems and the surveillance systems to actually see it happening. We had let them disappear over a number of years, and then we didn't know. We would have known sooner what was going on. And then finally, we need to increase our investment in research to find alternatives to opioids for the treatment of people in pain. The non-addictive drugs that can actually provide relief to people and avoid addiction. So that's a huge list. But these things can be done if we would just have the political will to do them.
You know, you mentioned at the beginning of that incredible list a culture change needed for prescribing drugs. And I was wondering specifically what can health professionals do better at that, you know, because obviously everyone's a player, as you said, but what can they do?
Well, so I think, again, this is a challenge in galvanizing the professional societies and agencies in medicine to do this and to do it in a coordinated way. This is a public health problem, and so the public health leadership of the country, you know, needs to take strong steps in this direction. I've mentioned the new Surgeon General is also, I think, strongly supportive of these actions. I mentioned the head of the FDA. One thing that people might remember, of a certain age anyway, is when the AIDS epidemic, the HIV/AIDS epidemic, developed in the late 1980s into the 1990s, it was indeed strong public health leadership that this needed to be treated as a, you know, as the serious medical problem that it was, and as a public health problem, and to avoid all the stigmatization and discrimination that phobic responses to AIDS were presenting at that time, that we needed a coordinated national response, and actually it made a huge difference. And now I'll mention George W. Bush as president. You know, this was a strong commitment that he personally made, and presidential leadership made a huge difference all over the world, not only in this country. Okay, so I think we need, and it was a public health directed effort, we need to do that for this problem also. And so from the national government all the way down to state medical societies, because they need to do something about what the requirements for licensure, you know, are going to be, and maybe some restrictions on, you know, recertification or something of that nature in terms of continuing prescribing. So we have levers that we can use to increase the incentives for medical schools to provide, you know, the level of pain management education that we need, of substance abuse. Identifying substance abuse problems and treating them. There are steps that can be taken, but they are going to require efforts at the state level and by professional medical societies.
Has your approach changed over the years, because you've been in this field for a while? And if so, how and why?
Well, that's a complicated question. You know, we're talking about opioids now.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I think people can recognize here is there have been tensions in our drug policy, you know, over the years, and particularly responses to, I mentioned, cocaine and heroin. Nobody is arguing for legalization, you know, of recreational or non-medical use of opioids and cocaine. But even within that framework, we have had, you know, a century and certainly decades of debate about, is this a public health problem or a medical problem? Should we use a medical response, or should we use a punitive law enforcement response? We declare war on drugs. We arrest people and say we're going to arrest our way out of this problem. Well, that doesn't work, and in fact, it causes huge problems on its own. So this cops versus docs attention that we have had in that area, we need to overcome that. It's both. We need enforcement. We've got to keep fentanyl, this very, very dangerous opioid, synthetic opioid, with a lot of which is coming in from China, out of this country. We have to have huge enforcement. So we have to have enforcement to do something about keeping the drugs out of the illegal marketplace. But ultimately, when you're talking about people that develop addiction, law enforcement is not the response, right? Treatment, education and treatment, you know, is the response to provide help and support for people that, you know, that develop this problem. So it's both, and we need to have a balanced approach. And over time, that has been a problem. Now, there are a lot of other drug issues in our country, including marijuana legalization and so on, which there are different, you know, attitudes that one can have about that. But right now, we need to focus on the opioid problem.
And do you feel like de-escalating criminal penalties for drug-related activity is as important as the other recommendations you made?
Well, it's a state of mind. Yes, I do think it's important because there are all the side effects, the unfortunate effects and costs of criminalization and punishment. So, yes, it is an important part of this. And I think, again, we there is a broader criminal justice reform movement that's also bipartisan, by the way, underway now because of the total overreaction and over-incarceration, you know, problem that we developed over these years, and part of it related, of course, to overreaction, you know, to drugs. So I think, again, we have bipartisan support for shifting the focus of the interventions for people with drug use disorders and particularly opioid problems in the direction of treatment. So that's a good thing. I don't think there's a fine of drug courts and a lot of other tools that can be used to provide the leverage that people sometimes need, you know, to get them into treatment and to, you know, to provide the services that they need. Right now, providing services through the criminal justice system is one of the areas potentially, you know, that is completely underutilized because of the tendency not to use some of these medications that are available to treat people with opioid addiction. A lot of judges traditionally have felt that you should get people off drugs and provide drug-free treatment to them. For many people with opioid use disorders, providing drug treatment is clearly the most effective thing to do, and we need to make those treatments available in the criminal justice system and out. And that, again, I just want to keep harping on that. That is a huge gap right now. We have effective treatments available, but we don't have people to provide them. We're not providing the financing for it. We need one thing, for example, to maybe a political note, we need to use Medicaid. We need to expand Medicaid and take advantage of the opportunities in Virginia, for example, to expand Medicaid to provide these services to people. And we don't want to gut Medicaid, you know, as some on the national level have been arguing that we need to do. And all the governors in the states that have had huge opioid problems have taken advantage of Medicaid expansion to provide the treatment. A third of the people with serious opioid disorders, non-elderly people with serious opioid disorders, are getting treatment under Medicaid. In this state, we have huge untreated population because of that.
Is there any hope politically because of that in terms of getting, you know, having health care? I know we're running a little short on time, but I just wanted to squeeze this in. In terms of, you know, getting expansion or getting health care available to people because of this crisis, could it be a leverage? Because because as you mentioned, at the state and local level, politicians on either side are seeing that this is a serious problem.
Yes, I think it has served in that way. Again, by raising the awareness of the seriousness of this problem and helping to convince people that a treatment, a public health response, a treatment response is a better approach than stigmatizing people and punishing them. That's a very important culture change that's going on now. It also is congruent with what we want to have happen in connection with mental health services, you know, as well. And so I do think that the populations that most benefit from Medicaid and Medicaid expansion is the people with untreated mental illness, unrecognized and untreated mental illness, and people with substance abuse disorders had to have no access to treatment. And particularly in rural areas where you have a sparsity of physicians and providers available. So one of the things in the president's message is increasing telemedicine access, you know, to appropriate people to provide these treatment. Everything that we are saying about opioids right now about this is true of people with mental illness also. So I think raising these behavioral health issues, you know, to a level of visibility so people can recognize the huge social costs that are associated with these disorders and that they are treatable. And that if we provide services to people, you know, they will be better off and we will be better off as well.
Well, thank you so, so much.
Good silver lining to it all. You're bringing in mental illness as a, you know, a side issue. That it's not a side issue, that it too might get some attention would be nice.
Yes.
Well, thank you so, so much, Richard, Bonnie. Hope maybe you'll come back sometime and talk more about the many other things that you're an expert in. Richard Bonnie is a director of the Institute of Law, University of Virginia. Okay. We were talking about the opioid epidemic in this country. We'll be talking with Ryan Wright, associate professor of the McIntyre School of Commerce. We're going to talk about cybersecurity and privacy, lots of other things.
Ellen, I totally think we should skip the news of note and start talking with Mr. Wright.
You do?
Mr. Wright now.
Yeah, let's do it. I'm almost ready.
That's true. I don't know if he's ready.
He's ready.
Okay,
am I ready?
Then I totally think we should do this.
Now a warning. I feel like, am I ready?
Okay. Sorry.
You're throwing me off.
You're important.
So we're going to talk with Richard, with Ryan Wright. And let's make sure everyone's ready. Are we all ready?
I did jump again.
Yeah, it's okay. So Ryan is an associate professor in the McIntyre School of Commerce at UVA. His research interests include cybersecurity and privacy and digital entrepreneurship. His research on cybersecurity has been funded by the state of Massachusetts and the National Science Foundation. He currently serves as vice president for the Association of Information Systems. He's the associate editor for the European Journal of Information Systems, is on the editorial board of the Journal of the Association for Information Systems. And today we're going to talk about lots of things that I've already described. So, Ryan, welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Morning.
Okay. So can you describe what it is that you study?
Yeah, that's a great question. So my training is from a business school, but I have a background also in cognitive psychology. So a lot of the things that I'm interested in is really how to build resilience in people and organizations to these cyber attacks. So I study the cyber attacks themselves, but I also look at the human psychology behind why we're falling for some of these attacks.
Wow. I had no idea.
Guys. Got this. I know it's a constant of psychiatry in this Saturday show. I know you're trying to cut to commercial. I'm going to be quiet.
Okay, we'll be right back after this short break. Come right back to WPVC 94.7. This is Apropos of Something. Welcome back, everybody. This is Apropos of Something on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We're talking with Ryan Wright, associate professor in the McIntyre School of Commerce at the University of Virginia, and we're talking about cybersecurity. And Ryan, we had to go to commercial, but you were just talking about the link with psychology. Talk more about that.
Yeah, so it's really interesting. I spent the past 13 years really examining why people fall for these cyber attacks and why organizations don't recognize the importance of these cyber attacks. And what we're seeing, because it's been in the news so heavily the last 3 years, is all of a sudden people are interested in this particular topic much more than they used to be. So I think there is a strong link between how people act in their job and things and how securely they behave online.
Who is susceptible to, like, for instance, a phishing attack?
Yeah, probably over the course of the last 10 years, as part of my research that has been approved by an institutional review board, I've fished over 13,000 people answering that particular question. And what we found some interesting things is, first of all, people think that there's these, you know, traits. You know, it's not your gender, it's not how old you are. And what we found is really the state of mind you're in when you receive that particular email. So, like, did your wife yell at you that morning? Are you in a bad mood? Are you sitting at your desk or walking down the street on your particular phone? So those contextual issues are much more important than actually who you are. So it's, from that respect, it's really hard to build resilience in people if you're trying to build in all these contexts when it's not just one factor that makes you susceptible, not susceptible.
How varied are these kinds of attacks, you know, and how sophisticated?
Yeah, the attacks are very sophisticated now. So it used to be, and we're probably all familiar with, when they sent out 100,000 and sometimes even close to a million emails, and our friend from Nigeria was getting us to invest in a particular thing that he was interested in. It's changed tremendously from that. So the average phishing campaign right now is 7 messages. And they are targeted towards you, much like Amazon targets their marketing towards you. So they looked at your Facebook. They may looked at your LinkedIn profile. They garner that particular information and target things that you know. One example is, I know a fellow that spoke at a conference on a panel. He received an email saying, "Hey, I heard you on the panel. This is great talk. Here's the PowerPoint slides that you requested." And the PowerPoint slides was actually malware that he installed. So these are getting very sophisticated. The one thing I will say is that 99.5% of these attacks, according to a recent IBM study, are done by non-state actors. These are amateurs that are trying to garner your information to turn around and sell that information on the black market, what they call the deep web.
Yes. Tell us what the deep web is.
Yeah, so the deep web has been called many things, but the easiest way to think about the deep web is anything that, say, Google or Bing cannot find when you do a search. So it's one of those things where you'll have to know the address, you'll have to use a specific browser, what they call a Tor browser, to access these particular websites. So there are legitimate websites on here that have different conversations around cybersecurity for professionals. They have different downloads you can do, but then there's a large majority of sites that are out there that are doing things like selling illicit drugs, or even worse, selling your information to different folks. So just a quick question for you folks. What do you think a social security number right now on the deep web is going for? So I did a quick search just before I got here to see what the market rate for your social security number is. What do you think it is?
I never even thought about this.
I know. I love that.
Anyway,
I love that we're being asked. I know.
So right now,
$1 million.
The going rate for a typical Social Security number is $1. And the reason why it's so cheap is because it's already out there. There's been so many breaches with Anthem, with the Office of Personnel at the White House, with Yahoo, with all these different vectors where they're gathering information. So much like marketers go out there and try and build a profile so they better know who you are, the cybersecurity criminals are doing exactly that. They're building of who you are, what your social security number is, what your past addresses is, where you work, etc., so they can turn around and sell that.
Wow. So where are these vulnerabilities in cybersecurity and privacy? How can we be less vulnerable?
Yeah, so right now we are looking at a psychological technique on how to build resilience called mindfulness. Now, you may have heard of mindfulness in the Eastern conceptualization where you are centered and you get a reminder on how to be centered, etc. We know in psychology that if you process information a certain way, that you're going to make better decisions. The problem is most of us process information automatically. So this is like today when I got up and got in the car and started driving, I drove to my kid's school, just an automatic response. We know we do the same thing through email. So if we actually build in mindfulness training in corporate training and individual training, that ability to say, hey, is this unique? Is this interesting? In other words, using that gut feel to make a decision, we're going to make better decisions. Our research suggests that you are 85% more likely to make the correct decision on an email if you're given this mindfulness training.
So what are there little techniques that you use? What does that incorporate?
Yeah, so the easiest way to think about this is the recent campaign that's out there called Stop, Check, and Think. And what we found is your gut is going to be right a lot of the time. So you just need to be aware of that. So if you pause even for less than a second to make a decision about an email or an action on your computer or something's funny, you're probably going to make the right decision on it. So always thinking about being aware of your environment and being aware of your gut feeling is really important to be a secure person, because the attacks are too good now for everyone to recognize. And the attacks are too good for technology to recognize. So this is a person problem.
So you think, are you saying that large organizations are better equipped to minimize this versus us as individuals?
Yeah, so I'm working with two very large federal organizations, and I can tell you they are not better equipped than the individual at all. In fact, they have a lot of different types of problems because of we have this indemnification model of cybersecurity right now. And if you think about it, it's much like using your credit card. So if you go out and use your credit card and somebody else charges on your particular credit card, you're not responsible for that particular charge. In a lot of respects, in corporate environments, if you go out and you click on something or you use data incorrectly, our IT department indemnifies you from that particular action. So they'll take your laptop, they'll say, oh, everything's okay, and they'll hand it back to you and not really knowing what's going on. So we need to change, really, how we view the IT security department, make it more human. In other words, you're not talking to the guys in the basement, and really making it onerous on the one who holds the data, which is you. So this is, cybersecurity problem isn't an organization problem, it's an employee problem.
So before we run out of time, I've been talking about Kaspersky for a while. Could you just give us a little background? What is it? What's been going on with our government and maybe even other countries, other players?
Yeah, that's a great question. I get asked that a lot about Kaspersky. So Kaspersky is an antivirus software, enterprise level protection for cybersecurity. They are a Russian company. Kaspersky is kind of famous in the antivirus space. He created some really unique algorithms that detect viruses very well. And just recently, there's been an accusation against Kaspersky that he's spying on U.S. government and individuals using the very software that's supposed to protect us. And I do want to say alleged, and I think that's an important thing. It's much like a lot of appliances that are being delivered by Chinese companies that are now in our particular networks. It's this nationalism that we have. So to me, it hasn't been proven, but it is a very much a concern. Because as we get these countries that we are not the friendliest in within our cyber infrastructure, and they may be or may not be listening, it is something that I think we should take a hard look at, the policy. Even if Kaspersky comes out perfectly clean, does it make sense that our government is protected by a Russian company?
Do you have similar, or what are your views then similarly with, for instance, how secure our election our states are with securing the votes from Election Day?
Yeah, that's a big problem, and I don't think that gets enough attention. So we've had, in the recent couple of years, our voting machines decertified because of cybersecurity threats. And even in the state of Virginia, Fairfax County has had multiple problems because of this. And just doing some simple things like securing the wireless connection between the voting machine and the wireless hub, and that was basically a very crackable open standard that hasn't been used in 15 years in any way, shape, or form. So really, that was changed because of citizen cyber activism saying, hey, listen, I'm going in to vote, and I see this open network and this traffic in our votes flying around in this open network. Something needs to change. So we've decertified those machines, thank goodness, the so-called win vote machines that have changed. But I think this is an opportunity for citizens who understand cyber security a little bit to go in that environment and provide some expertise and some activism. And that's exactly what happened in the case of Fairfax County, where an IT professional wrote an op-ed saying, we can no longer use these machines because they are unsecure.
Are you a one-issue voter on security?
Oh, I have an easy answer for that. I'm Canadian, so I use that when anyone asks me a political question. We have probably the most handsome leader right now, I do want to say, of the free world. So,
Speaking of wireless connections, that may in fact be in Canada for all I know, but how wary should we be of the cloud? I don't think we talk enough about that. I'm sure there's a million things in there that are wrong.
Yeah, so the cloud, as we know it, like, say, your Dropbox, or you're storing your files in Google Drive, et cetera. And I get this question a lot from small businesses, is should I trust my data on the cloud? And I say, are you better than Google at securing your data? Are you better than Dropbox? Do you have professionals that are monitoring your network, and that's all they do and think about? And so the cloud for me is, can somebody get your data? Absolutely. But can they get it more easily if you're trying to manage that process process yourself. I'll tell you what's scarier than that, and I've talked about this a little bit in a recent Washington Post article, is the traveling around with the wireless. So when you go to hotels, when you go to airports, assume people can look and read at everything that you're doing. And that's the right mental model. I think that is a bigger threat vector than you storing information on a cloud to a company that really, really thinks about security all the time. So that's what I would offer folks out there, not to be so much worried about the cloud, but be more worried about using these wireless connections that we jump on everywhere without really thinking about who we're connecting to.
So speaking of nefarious networks, what's the difference between the dark web and the deep web?
Yeah, so they're subsets of each other. So the deep web is anything you can't find with Google or Bing or a search engine. The deep web is where all the nefarious activities take place. So that's where they can buy and sell drugs. That's where you hear the crazy stories of buying hitmen for particular things. And so those marketplaces do exist, and that's what they're calling kind of the deep web. And by the way, that's where you would buy information about you. That's where I would find your social security number. That's where I would find your credit profile in its entirety. And that's where I would request saying, hey, I would like a credit profile that has above 720 score that lives in Virginia, and somebody would go out and find that for me.
It reminds me of the...
Listen, if you go looking for Ellen's social security number today, I guarantee you it's more than a dollar.
It just reminds me of the tunnels under New York that I didn't know existed. You know, Nancy, there's a lot of... Under the subway, there's like these mole people. There are books written on that. There's just a whole society, I think, underground. So it's something that I had no idea existed.
Yeah, most of what Ryan has been telling us today,
right.
I had no idea existed.
Right.
Anyway.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, what's the one security tip you'd give us before we say so long?
Yeah, so right now, one of the biggest threats to folks is this thing called ransomware, where a malicious piece of software is downloaded, and there's a bunch of different ways, including these open wireless connections, that could happen, typically done through email, and it locks all your files. And in order to unlock your files, you need to provide them Bitcoin or money. So this is happening consistently. In fact, there was a large ransomware attack of hospitals in the UK just recently, where it locks down all these machines. So rather than get yourself in a situation where you have to say, how much is my data worth? What I would suggest that you do is really back up your files often. So that is backing up your files using an online backup service, but that is not a file synchronization service such as Dropbox, because it'll synchronize the encrypted files. That is using a true backup. Or what I do is I keep three copies of any files that I think are important. One copy on my computer, one copy on a USB drive that I change every once in a while, and I use a product called Carbonite, which uploads it, and it does a backup to the cloud again. I'm a fan of the cloud.
If only there was a way to, just like with a long time ago, people would put their money under their mattress. I wish there was a way you could just store all your data under your mattress where no one would find it.
Well, and some of my privacy research suggests, and other people have famously suggest that your data really isn't yours anyways. So that mental model needs to change. It's shared between you and somebody else, either a bank or a person or whomever.
Well, thank you so much for being here, Ryan Wright, professor at the McIntyre School, all things cybersecurity and privacy. We'll look for your Washington Post article. And Richard Bonney,
I'm sure he's emailed it to us secretly already.
Probably. It's in the deep web. And Richard Bonney, thank you so much for being here and for staying with us.
Absolutely.
So, Nancy, we really have like 15 seconds.
I know. No, I think you should do all the things you like to do that I don't give you time to do at the end of the show.
Well, I think I will. Our theme music, thank you so much to Springtide from Japan. The theme is called N3540-19800, a cyber title. Thank you to the Beckham team at Keller Williams for sponsoring us. And remember, no one has to do everything, but everyone has to do something. We'll see you next week. Bye, Nance.
Okay. Bye.